This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The number of deaths related to COVID-19 virus worldwide is 184,000, with 2.6 million confirmed infections. In the United States, the number of deaths is shy of 48,000, or more than 25% of the worldwide tally. The number of infections in the U.S. is nearly 850,000. U.S. President Donald Trump on Wednesday signed an executive order to temporarily block some foreigners from permanent residence in the United States, saying he was doing so in order to protect American workers during the coronavirus pandemic. The order is the last 60 days and then will be reviewed and possibly extended. Some critics see the Republican president's announcement as a move to take advantage of the coronavirus crisis to implement a long-sought policy goal of barring more immigrants ahead of the November 3rd election. The president said it will preserve the health care resources for American patients afflicted by the coronavirus. White House lawyers worked all day to craft the language for the order, prompting some officials to say the signing might have to wait for Thursday. But aides described Mr. Trump as eager to sign the document. One U.S. Department of Homeland Security official who requested anonymity said the order would only apply to people applying for permanent residence from outside the United States, not those already in the country seeking to adjust their status. The director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention was called on by President Trump on Wednesday to walk back his remark that the second wave of coronavirus in the fall could be worse than the current situation. CDC Director Robert Redfield made the widely circulated comment in an interview Tuesday with the Washington Post. Mr. Trump tweeted Wednesday morning that the health expert was misquoted. Redfield, however, said he was quoted accurately. This is VOA News. In China, where the novel coronavirus started, by the end of reporting Wednesday, the Chinese mainland recorded 10 new confirmed COVID-19 cases, of which six were imported. The National Health Commission on Thursday said of the four new native cases, three were reported from a northeast province and one from the south. London's tourist and business hotspots were largely deserted Wednesday again, as British Prime Minister Boris Johnson faced a call for an inquiry into his government's handling of the coronavirus crisis. The criticism centers on the government failing to fully explain partial death data, limited testing, or the lack of equipment for hospitals. Johnson initially refrained from approving the stringent controls that other European leaders imposed, but he later closed down the country when projections showed a quarter of a million people could die in the United Kingdom alone. Since the lockdown, though, the government has given conflicting explanations of why it failed to join a European Union ventilator scheme and admitted that there have been problems getting health workers enough protective equipment. Brazil's health minister, Nelson Teich, told media on Wednesday that the country could not survive under a long-term lockdown, adding that the ministry will work with Brazil's regions to open up the country amid the spread of the coronavirus. His comments come after Sao Paulo, a state, announced it will gradually reopen its economy in a safe way starting May 11th by relaxing some social distancing measures put in place to stop the spread of the new coronavirus. Given the size and diversity of Brazil, he said it was up to states to do what is right for their region. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announced Wednesday that two pet cats have been confirmed as suffering from SARS-CoV-2, the virus which causes COVID-19. It's the first time the virus has been found in domestic animals in the United States. The cats were in different areas of New York State, and both were taken to vets suffering from mild respiratory illness. The first cat came from a household in which none of the residents had any symptoms. The second cat's owner was later diagnosed with COVID-19. However, another cat in the same household appeared to show no signs of infection. Both cats are expected to make a full recovery. The Trump administration has quietly added military surveillance cameras at the U.S.-Mexico border in response to the coronavirus pandemic. The cameras and deployment of 540 more troops come despite a nine-month decline in apprehension that indicates fewer people are crossing illegally. The Associated Press obtained internal military documents saying the Department of Defense provided 60 mobile surveillance cameras this month at the request of the Department of Homeland Security. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 23rd. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Ghana's main opposition party says President Akufo-Addo's lifting of a COVID-19 partial lockdown was ill-advised.
We as an opposition are not against the lifting of the ban, but the time it is lifted is what we think is not correct.
A spokesperson says Sierra Leone President Madabio's self-quarantine is not impacting his official duties. A WHO official says President Trump's suspension of funding could impact Africa the most. Medical scientists commend South Africa for more COVID-19 testing. And Human Rights Watch accuses Kenyan police of killings during COVID-19 curfew enforcement.
From our research, we have found that at least 6 people died as a result of the curfew. Most of those as a result of beatings from the police.
And more people are being arrested for peddling COVID-19 related falsehoods. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ghana's main opposition, National Democratic Congress, the NDC, says President Nana Akufo-Addo's decision to lift the coronavirus partial lockdown in the country was ill-advised. One of the reasons the president cited for lifting the lockdown was his concern about the impact it was having on the informal sector. Professor Margaret Kweku, a member of the opposition NDC COVID-19 technical team, says President Akufo-Addo did not follow World Health Organization guidelines, particularly at a time when the number of COVID-19 cases in Ghana are higher today than when the president first announced the partial lockdown.
I want to say that the party has not reacted differently from what others or Ghanaians are also doing. We think that this lifting of the partial lockdown should have been done differently. This is because we need to go by the WHO guidelines for lifting the lockdown. I can just mention one or two that I think we have not yet achieved. That is, transmission of the infection has not been brought under control. We started the lockdown in the two cities, that is Accra and Kumasi, when we had less than 200 cases. Now we are talking of more than 1,000 cases. And this is the time we are lifting the ban. We as an opposition are not against the lifting of the ban, but the time it is lifted is what we think is not correct.
One of the reasons the president gave for lifting the partial lockdown was that he was concerned about the impact that the lockdown was having on the Ghanaians in the informal sector of the economy.
I realize that you stress so much on what the party has been doing to support the informal sector. As I mentioned earlier, we have been supporting community members. But one thing our flag bearer has done, which is remarkable, is to make a lot of suggestions and proposals to government. The first one was reduction of utility tariffs. That is what end electricity. He went further to propose that there should be reduction in telecommunication charges, and that has also been accepted. To the business sector again, our former president was able to establish a stabilization fund, which government is now going to fall on to make sure they support the business environment for them to move on with their business. Since this outbreak has really caused a breakdown in our businesses, a lot of people have lost their jobs, a lot of people are in debt, and they cannot even pay their rents.
What do you say to Ghanaians or to people who might think that the opposition you are voicing to the lifting of the lockdown is perhaps influenced by Ghanaian politics?
I would like to tell all citizens of Ghana that NDC is not opposing government because they are in opposition. All the issues we have raised, I think, they are not negative.
Professor Margaret Kweku, a spokesperson for Ghana's main opposition, National Democratic Congress. She was speaking with us from Hohwe in the Volta region. Sierra Leone President Julius Maada Bio continues his 14-day self-quarantine after one of his bodyguards tested positive for the coronavirus. The number of COVID-19 cases in Sierra Leone has risen to about 50. Information Minister Mohamed Rahman Sware says the president wanted to set an example for all Sierra Leoneans to follow. He also says the self-quarantine has not impacted President Maada Bio's ability to carry on his official duties.
His Excellency President Julius Maada Bio decided to go into self-isolation as a sign of moral leadership. So he decided to go into self-isolation not because he or any member of his family has shown any symptoms, but simply because he wanted to send a loud and clear message to all Sierra Leoneans to do the needful in circumstances. One of his security guards got an exposure and tested positive. So he wanted to leave nothing to chance. That is why he went into self-isolation. And this move has been commended by Sierra Leoneans all over the world.
What about the president's personal family? Have they also been tested?
It is part of the EOC's diligence to ensure that immediately someone is tested positive, they immediately activate the surveillance and contact tracing mechanisms to ensure that all primary and secondary contacts of the positive case are identified, isolated, taken to treatment centers and cared for. That is currently on course. As a matter of fact, His Excellency the President went into self-isolation with all members of the first family who were domiciled at the State Lodge as at the time of this incident.
How will the President go about fulfilling his daily executive duties during the 14-day self-quarantine?
President Bio is one of those African leaders who appreciates the beauty and the enormous contributions of digitalization. As a result of that, he conducts many emergency operations, coordinates show meetings virtually, and he has held about 3 cabinet meetings virtually. So nothing lost, and he remains very firmly in course, ably supported by a competent vice president and a team of professionals.
It seems that Sierra Leone is witnessing a daily increase in the number of coronavirus cases. Is the president considering additional measures?
We will continue to take every rare and practical step to ensure that we contain the virus and deal with it decisively. So as I speak to you, every measure is on the table. We have been reluctant to declare a nationwide lockdown for very obvious reasons. His Excellency President Bio wants to take a decision that is supported by data that has compelling evidence. Now we have started having indications of possible community transmission, so the idea of a lockdown now becomes very palpable. Again, that is for His Excellency to decide.
At least 6 people died from police violence during the first 10 days of Kenya's dusk to dawn curfew imposed late March to contain the spread of COVID-19. Human Rights Watch says in a new report that police, without apparent justification, shot and beat people at marketplaces as well as those returning home from work, even before the curfew time. As Marie Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, the Human Rights Agency is raising concerns over what it says is increased police brutality in Kenya.
On March 25th, President Uhuru Kenyatta announced a government plan for a nationwide dusk to dawn curfew starting March 27 as one of the measures to curb coronavirus. The Human Rights Watch says police appear to have enforced it in a chaotic and violent manner from the start. In downtown Nairobi, police arrested people on streets, whipping, kicking and herding them together, increasing the risk of spreading the virus. Speaking to VOA, senior Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch, Otieno Namwaya, said that Police have since violated human rights by attacking people instead of protecting them against the virus.
From our research, we have found that at least 6 people died as a result of the curfew. Most of those 6 are as a result of beatings from the police. But beside the beatings and killings, I think the brutality of the police is much more widespread than the numbers of those who are dead is telling. There are a lot of people who are nursing injuries because of police beatings. There are a lot of people who have lost businesses because of police either demanding bribes or looting.
The agency report indicates that in Embakasi area of Eastern Nairobi, police officers forced a group of people walking home from work to kneel, then whipped and kicked them. Mr. Namwaya says the brutality is worse in rural areas and the government has failed to engage members of the public in fight against COVID-19.
And it is worse in the villages because there's no one there to record. Police brutality is unjustified. You have seen countries which have been most hit, like Italy, but you have not seen police beating people because this is not civil unrest. This is a containment measure to prevent an infectious disease from spreading. And therefore, what government needs is not force, but engagement with the public and persuasion. That's what government has failed on.
Between March 29th and April 14th, Human Rights Watch conducted phone interviews with 26 witnesses, relatives and victims of abuses related to the curfew in Nairobi, Mombasa, Kwale, Busia, Kakamega, Mandera and Homa Bay counties, revealing severe police abuses in the community. Despite the report indicating police brutality, Kenya's Inspector General of Police, Hilary Mutyambai, said that police will ensure Ministry of Health measures are followed.
People are defying these directives. Arrogant groups continue harassing the members of public in defiance of the law, including what happened on Tuesday on 14th in Malindi. I wanted to bring this one to the attention of Kenyans that police are there to protect Mwananchi and police are there to enforce the laws of this country.
Human Rights Watch says Kenyan authority should urgently investigate instances in which police shot, beat or abused people, killing or seriously injuring them, and hold those responsible to account. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 23rd. A senior World Health Organization official says President Donald Trump's decision to suspend U.S. funding for the World Health Organization could deter Africa's ability to stamp out not only the coronavirus, but other deadly diseases. Simon Marks reports from Addis Ababa.
The U.S. is the main funder of WHO programs linked to malaria, polio, and HIV/AIDS in Africa. Currently, the U.S. has pledged $400 million to the WHO's $4.8 billion 2020-2021 budget. While its pledges are mostly locked in for this year, WHO officials expect the U.S. funding suspension to start biting in 2021. Michelle Yao, Emergency Operations Program Manager at the WHO's Regional Office for Africa, spoke to VOA via a messaging app.
This support is what helped to provide technical support or even to have a technical position in a country. Some of them, a program like malaria, need to have a continuous support based in a WHO country office. So all this technical position and also work that is required while convening aspects to work on a specific guideline for a given disease. This is also the funding was helping, and sometimes even in some of the supply, maybe on the HIV issues. So all this, of course, will suffer if this gap is not covered.
For COVID-19 prevention efforts, the WHO has repurposed many of its staff to deal with the outbreak. While money has been set aside for 2020, question marks hang over those roles for next year.
In the case of COVID, some of these technical people that has been repurposed. And of course, most of them got the contract extended, but maybe from next year, if we don't have enough funds and we have to cut on staff, it will also affect, because some of them have been repurposed based on that. If this shortage continues, it will definitely affect our HR plan for next year.
Yao denounced claims that the WHO was slow to respond to the coronavirus outbreak or that the organization has been too China-centric. He said that a team of international experts was sent to Wuhan, where the original outbreak occurred, as early as January 1st to report on the scale and danger of the outbreak. The WHO, in partnership with other UN agencies, has begun delivering personal protective equipment around Africa by using Addis Ababa as its central cargo hub. World Food Programme planes last week began delivering emergency health workers across the region. But a sheer lack of basic and technical equipment, such as ventilators and clinical care beds, are troubling many policymakers in the region. John Nkangasong, director of the Africa CDC, told reporters last week that at least 10 countries in Africa have no ventilators whatsoever. Another major concern for health authorities in Africa is the impact the COVID-19 crisis will have on other diseases. The WHO fears it will see vaccine-preventable diseases like measles, rubella, polio, and diphtheria become more commonplace. Simon Marks for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
In South Africa, medical scientists are commending the government for testing increasing numbers of people for COVID-19. The country is running what's now the biggest coronavirus testing program in Africa. Darren Taylor reports.
Respected virologist Francois Venter initially criticized South Africa's rollout of testing for COVID-19 as far too slow. He said it was failing to use the National Health Laboratory Service's vast experience from managing South Africa's HIV testing program.
They scaled up the HIV viral load in an unprecedented way. South Africa has by far and away the biggest program in the world. And they did it quickly. So you've got good people there. These people weren't being put in charge, or there was no discussion with them. And there was no real plan in place for this scaling up. So what happened instead?
The result, says Venter, was that testing for coronavirus was, up until recently, the responsibility of South Africa's private health facilities.
Yeah, rather than turning around and saying, so what are we doing in terms of the capacity building that we need to require for a countrywide process? Everyone was criticizing the private sector for doing all the tests.
At that stage, says Venter, with so few tests being done, the country was heading towards the high infection rates and death tolls seen in other parts of the world.
The private sector doesn't have even close to the capacity of the public sector PCR labs. So I think a lot of us were getting more and more worried that we were going on this massive lockdown, buying time for nothing.
But he says the progress over the last few days has been remarkable, and the scientists who should have been in charge of the testing project from the start are now at the helm.
From what I can see, there's been a dramatic injection of energy and capacity, and it looks like they're tooling up rapidly. Now we just need to get people tested and get the tests to them.
Testing is most urgent in the public sector because it reaches most of the population of 57 million. However, public facilities have been doing only 1,000 tests a day. Health Minister Zweli Mkhize says this number is increasing rapidly as 11,000 field workers fan across the country to screen for COVID-19.
On the last 24 hours, we've actually performed over 7,194. And this is because of the strategy of increasing to massively test our people. It cannot be expected that you can get all those thousands immediately, but you have to keep pushing the number up because we have to...
Mkhize says South Africa is doing more testing than some better resourced nations, partly due to its experience of widespread HIV testing. The latest statistics released by President Cyril Ramaphosa appear to support this.
3,465 confirmed cases of coronavirus have been identified. More than 2 million people have been screened in communities across the country. And of these, over 15,000 have been referred for proper testing.
Venter adds that South Africa's challenge still remains monumental.
35,000 tests. We need to do that number every single day going forward.
Mkhize says he's confident that the state and its healthcare workers will get to this level soon. The question then, says Venter, is whether the country will have the capacity to isolate, hospitalize, and treat all the new patients. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
South Africa, Malawi, and Zimbabwe have begun to arrest people for peddling COVID-19-related falsehoods. Ade Gondo has more on the story.
Zimbabwean police on Monday made their first arrest under lockdown regulations aimed at fighting the coronavirus pandemic. Love Mozo Kusekwa, 36, appeared in court in Harare on charges of publishing or communicating false statements prejudicial to the state. Zokusekwa allegedly authored a fake statement bearing President Mnangagwa's signature announcing the original 21-day lockdown was being extended. It circulated on social media. Mnangagwa had ordered an investigation into the document's origin. Spreading fake news on social media and mainstream media about COVID-19 is punishable by up to 20 years in prison. Constitutional law expert Love Momaduku speaks on the law.
That provision has always been there. What they did, the COVID-19 regulation, lockdown regulation, they simply notified the public of the existence of that, of we are invoking it. So they didn't create a new offense, which applies only during COVID-19.
Zimbabwe joins South Africa and Malawi in making such arrests, which have led media organizations to reflect on the possible implications for their professions. Tabani Moyo, the executive director of the Media Institute of Southern Africa in Zimbabwe, speaks.
It started in South Africa. It started with South Africa and everything that happens in South Africa. You know, we are now in a catch-based mode in Zimbabwe. It started with South Africa. Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, adopted. Zimbabwe adopted. India is on the process of adopting. So it is a top-down approach in terms of understanding COVID.
Since the matter is before the courts, Moyo said his organization has not issued an official statement on the matter yet.
We want to make a comprehensive approach to it so that we do not leave loopholes. Our legal team is detailed as we speak.
The deputy president of the Zambia Institute of Independent Media Alliance, Jubio Zulu, says it's not always easy for the public to distinguish between a professional journalist and ordinary citizens on social media.
The new media has posed a lot of misconception on the journalist. At the end of the day, you find that people, when they want to judge a journalist, they'll go further to say this is what they post, without understanding that on social media there's a lot of things that do happen, and there's a lot of people that are found on social media and they are all not journalists. So we must understand what the difference is between a media personnel and those that are found on social media. That embraces everyone and anyone can post anything.
Observers say governments could use the rules to suspend civil liberties and crush dissenting voices. They cite the recent cancellation of Zambian independent television station Prime Television's license for allegedly refusing to air government-produced COVID-19 promos. Reporting for VOA, this is Ade Gondo.
And that's it for this Thursday, April 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that you have a good day.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat and dumbolo and makosa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Make a difference by honoring ordinary people doing extraordinary things to help one another. VOA encourages you to tell us about everyday people who have shown leadership in your communities during the coronavirus crisis. Submit your nominations to VOA Leaders at voanews.com. Send us your name, phone number, and email, and a VOA reporter will contact you. We're all in this together.